actually my personal favorite issue of this arc.
I
really dug this issue for multiple reasons, but the very first thing, and I this has to be snuck in, but I do love that it is what's his name from Eastbound and Down, the actors. I don't know
this
why
was
I'm
not
blanking on his
cleared
name.
By me. By
yeah,
the way.
I assumed that it was probably a little snuck in thing.
And I'm a huge Eastbound and Down fan.
Danny McBride.
So, yeah, and I just I have a hell of a time reading this bit without hearing the voice. And if I would have known that he was going to cast him in this, you know, there's no way that we could have gotten through it without him saying, "You're fucking out, I'm fucking in." There's just no way. There's no way that that wouldn't have happened. There's no way that he wouldn't have injected steroids directly into his ass.
That makes for a completely different sequence of events.
There's just no way that that stuff would not have been in the book. So it's just a miscommunication between me and Joe, really. Just like, yeah, we'll get to the other one down the road. But yeah, this was one of my favorite Easter eggs. A fantastic choice on his part.
Now, you know, I think this is sort of something that everybody does. But, you know, when you're reading any comic, really, if you enjoy a character enough, you sort of cast him like an
sure.
actor.
Right.
When you're looking at Morning Glories and the hypothetical future movie, television show, miniseries adaptation,
right.
If the option came up, would you want to put Danny McBride in as this character just because?
I can't think of a greater honor than having Kenny Powers in any future media adaptation of Morning Glories. Really, I mean, it would just I can't imagine a better thing happening. I would love to see a Jody Hill directed episode of a Morning Glories TV show. That could just be something so far beyond what I could ever come up with. So yeah, fingers crossed for that someday.
So outside of the cameo of this sequence, on the more serious aspects,
you know, not to cut you off, but that's it. You know, but this isn't outside the realm of possibility. I mean, what's his name from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia made several appearances on Lost.
It's true.
You know,
and
so
the first time he did it, he wasn't like really known as Mac at the
right.
time. Whereas
right.
when he reappeared in season six, I think everybody
right.
by that point just started laughing.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, no, I forget the actor's name. The guy that plays Dennis
sure.
was in that one movie, The Strangers.
Oh, right.
He
right.
like shows up and gets shot.
Right.
Yeah.
See? So.
So this sequence, Massachusetts, 1963, and already I'm fond of it because, you know, I live in Massachusetts. So whenever we get shown somewhere, it's always like hometown pride.
Well, I don't think that we screwed up Massachusetts as bad as we screwed up Iowa. So we got this one right.
The obvious reference here, though, in the 1693, is that's the year the Salem witch trials ended. Am I picking up on this
right.
correctly?
Yep.
But the thing that I didn't know about when we were doing our research and notes for the issue is does this character, I don't think he ever gets a name, but is there a way that he's sort of referred to? I guess we can just call him Danny.
Sure, sure. Let's just refer to him as Kenny Powers.
So this, they're doing this thing which we found out is called crushing.
Right.
It's
a real thing.
No, there's a real word for it or phrase for it in French. But my French
right,
is terrible.
Right.
It's
yeah.
like,
yeah.
Yeah. It means both. Hard and forceful punishment.
Right. We'll both butcher the French, but yeah.
So, you know, we sort of lightly talked about it with the last issue and the cave and what I can assume you're referencing and what you know you're referencing. But this one is more of a blatant thing. So is this something that you had just known about and wanted to incorporate? Or is this something that you did a little research on and wanted to bring in?
Yeah, I did a little research here. Not a terrible amount or anything, but I wanted to make sure that we do our best to try to be as historically accurate as we can. It's obviously tricky, and you can never get things 100% right, but yeah, I wanted something that fit with the times, and this was actually something that was employed with at least reasonable frequency that we know of back during the Salem hysteria. So yeah, it's a bad way to go.
And I'm going to go out on a limb here and assume that it's important that you said it during the witch trials, that's not just a convenient sort of thing.
Sure. It's absolutely a reason why this time period is when this happens, yeah.
So the interesting thing about this entire sequence, and you know, they you keep coming back to Kenny here throughout the issue, but this is a flashback, if we can call that, because no one is flashing back to it. But this is a flashback-esque sequence that none of the characters are at least consciously aware of. You know, maybe somebody in the future in our timeline is sort of keen to what's going on here, but we don't know about that yet. Right. So how is it that, you know, for the most part, we have all these, like, moments that reveal more about the kids' lives in the past, like Casey and Zoe and Hunter. What was the decision to give a flashback sequence that assumedly no one can relate to right now?
Well, we've done something similar back in issue 3.
Right.
You know, so this isn't the first time that you've seen a sort of flashback to something disconnected from the kids themselves and disconnected from this time period. And in both cases, you see that things that are happening then are in some way impacting things that happen in our present day sequence, or allude to things in our present day sequence, or reference things in our present day sequence. So you can certainly see that there's an interconnectedness here, and it felt like it was time to come back and revisit that part of the story. It had been a little while, so it was something that I wanted to remind the readers of as much as anything, that this is a part of our narrative, and it's something that we'll see more of.
In terms with the general story that you have about the main characters, I'm going to probably guess here that you have just as sort of concise of a map of how the historical elements play into that as well.
Yeah, certainly. I know how it all fits together. It's not as though I kind of wake up and I'm like, I want to do a Revolutionary War story and you know, cram it into Morning Glories. So yeah, it all fits within the larger puzzle.
So the last question that I want to ask about the sequence right now, the way, and you know, Crit and I didn't talk about this at all, because this is sort of, we like to get into specific notes and annotations. But is this scene sort of a metaphor for what's to come, given the, not that anybody gets, you know, rocks dumped on mm-hmm. them, but that's the sort of idea of having a giant weight crushing down on you.
Sure. There are lots of parallels here, and that's not a bad one to think about. But you know, I think in a way that's already sort of revealed itself.
Mm-hmm. So I would sort of casually call this issue a Zoe issue. I don't know if that's specifically correct, because it's, you know, we've got the scene in 1693, and we've also got some nice scenes with the teachers here, and this is mainly the big time that we see a lot of the teachers, I think, throughout this arc.
Yeah.
But what occurs to me is that you know, we have the we in the last issue we'd sort of talked about the layout of the school, and as soon as we see Gribbs, Daremount, and Hodge on the same place, there is a map on the table.
Right.
So that might this might be a better inquiry for Joe, actually. Mm-hmm. But is do you in terms of you knowing that map, is that
No. And that's why Joe, I think, very wisely stacked papers all over it, just so that it could be of no help to anyone. But, you know, again, Joe is the person to talk to about this stuff, because he, like I said, he does a very good job of keeping it all straight so that I can just be like, and then there's a giant pit over here. You know, so right. he keeps all of that from falling apart on me.
Mm-hmm. Another thing, and actually, you know, I'm going to put off that question. I'm going to ask this because it literally just occurs to me now. But given mm-hmm. the way that these things sort of play out, and that smaller ideas and things become more important later on, there sure. are two things in this initial sequence of Lara going to meet the other teachers that stand out to me. One that I'm going to guess is important, and one that I'm going to guess is not.
Okay.
The first one is she runs by a kid who's calling out for her attention named Will.
Mm-hmm.
Any chance that we're going to see Will again, or is this just sort of a...
There is no chance you're going to see Will again.
Oh, poor Will.
Who knows, really, but no plans.
The other one is the light cracking in through the wall near the door. Mm-hmm. And I can't help but assume that that's pretty on purpose.
It's an astute eye, but it's not. I think Alex maybe got a little, that's a well illuminated hallway, isn't it? no, you know, yeah, it's just an emergency light. You know, they're down in the basement and, nope, nothing. But I, you know, look, this is a good way to dig. You'll find stuff more often than not.
I mean, I actually had assumptions of what it could have been connected to, but, it's good to know that I can relax a little bit. Although I will note, and this was originally what made me want to talk about these few pages, there's a lot of people going downstairs in this book.
Sure. Yeah.
And so far, and actually in my study hall notes for this issue, I mm-hmm. don't remember, and gosh, it actually could happen later on in another issue, but I don't remember anybody going upstairs at any point. It's all whenever people are in the school, they're always going down into some mysterious sub-basement or something along those lines.
Right.
Is this a conscious decision to have people
yes.
always moving yes. downward?
Yes. Now that's important. That just we do see with recurring significance that they have to go downstairs for a lot of things. So yeah, that's important.
Okay. So I'm going to go ahead and skip most of the teacher stuff for now and save it all for the end, because okay. I want to talk about the other things first in this issue. But
sure.
Zoe,
right?
She is, you know, a lot of people's favorites here, and mm-hmm. and we've seen, and this whole arc has some obviously pretty big Zoe moments,
right?
But the sort of unfortunate thing about her is that she is largely sort of not quite sympathetic. You know, I forget exactly what her quote is for those initial Morning Glories promos, but out of, like, everybody's, like, most likely to, you know, do something cool or, you know, be funny, and I forget what hers, right. but it wasn't very nice.
Right, sure.
So how important was it to, before everything kicks off and everything gets really bad, how important was it to really try and paint her in an actually sympathetic light for you?
Well, I wanted to make sure she was a three-dimensional character. Certainly, she's. A lot of people always ask, sort of, who's your favorite to write, and I always kind of duck the question because it is like picking between kids. But in a lot of ways, Zoe was my favorite to write. I liked her approach and her sense of humor, and she's just great in a scene. And she's sort of the comics equivalent of the camera loving her. You know, that she tends to dominate the scenes that she's in. So, she never was a sort of stereotypical, you know, quote unquote bitch character. That was just never her role, and she always had more to her than that. And so while she's often the foil or often the cynic or often the smartass, there was always more to her than that. And part of the fun with the character was that you were never quite sure where you stood with her. You know, with Ike, you know that he's sort of gonna make it rough for you, and you know that he's gonna make the wrong choice more often than not. With Zoe, she had a tendency from day one to surprise us, to sort of talk like a very disenchanted, uncaring, cold person. But then, you know, when the chips were down, we'd see over and over that she would come through, and it helped make her, I think, a much better character. And I cared a lot about this sequence because there were a lot of people who, the first time we sort of rolled through Hunter losing his temper, you know, there were a lot of people who were really cheering him on there, and a lot of people who, you know, seemed to view Hunter as the good guy in that situation. I actually never did. I think that I can certainly empathize and understand where Hunter's coming from, but, you know, in my personal experience, letting it all out like that, rarely do good things come of it. And you know, what we see is that it has a real effect on Zoe. You know, especially when compounded with what she hears from people who don't know that she's around. And you know, we see that she's not unmoved by this stuff, that she's not unaffected by it. So it was important to me to get that across, you know, that there's a side to her story too, even if she is the one who puts up a tougher front and the one who's maybe not the friendliest. But, you know, there's certainly a lot of sympathetic qualities to the character.
The other sort of obvious factor about Zoe, it's right from the beginning because, you know, we segue from the teachers talking into the dialogue. They will fall into your trap soon enough with a shot of Zoe.
Right.
And now, obviously, you know, before this, Crit and I had our sort of assumptions about, you know, who she really was, or maybe what we want to call her powers, or something along those lines. But it's an interesting mix of, you know, the lighter narrative here, where you want to sympathize with Zoe, and at the same time, it's very, very foreboding,
right,
of what's to come.
Well, you know, that's a lot of what 14, 15, and 19 are about. Is, I think what we pulled off here is we really left the jury out on the character until the last possible moment, and that was a lot of fun to watch the sort of reader journey on that. You know, by the way that we frame things and by what we showed and what we didn't show, you're really not convinced up until her last moment, you know, that is who she is and that's the path that she's gone down. And to me, that's the best kind of homicidal killer, really. So, yeah, I mean, that was really important, you know, that we not sort of issue a final verdict on who she is. And I do think that we pulled that off because every time we did an issue with her, people would bend over backwards to sort of absolve her of guilt or find a kind of a loophole or take responsibility for her own actions away from her. And that's good. You know, that's what we wanted. So, again, you know, where it leaves you is hopefully in a real place of heartbreak for the character if she was one that you liked.
So getting into a more specific question now, you know, she wanders into Hodge's office here, mm-hmm. and she picks up the picture on the desk, and we don't see who is in that picture.
Right.
So I can only assume that that means that the picture is an important reference to something.
We will show you at some point what the picture is, yes.
And is it...
And Zoe certainly seems... It certainly seems to give her pause. So
that was going to be my next question, actually, because it would almost seem like she might recognize the picture.
Possibly. she certainly, you know, takes note of it,
mm-hmm.
And thinks that there's something about it worth stopping and paying attention to.
So the, I got to figure out how to ask you about this in a clever fashion. We're given our Salem witch trial sequence again, and I think the obvious moment at the end is when Kenny Powers says, what did you see when your eyes were opened?
Sure.
So, you know, the sort of obvious way to think about it, I think, for Crit and I, or whatever, is that we're seeing an early version of what would someday become the Morning Glory Academy. Is that probably an astute observation or assumption?
I think it's certainly, yeah, that there's something here that has a lot of commonality with what we see at the Academy, and that there's a definite and distinct interconnectedness. So, yeah, there have been plenty of allusions at this point, I think, to the fact that this is maybe not something that is specific to this generation or time, and that this is something that may have been going on for a very long time.
Given that there are no specific rules for Woodrun,
right.
And given that earlier in the issue, which is, again, kind of why I wanted to skip over it, because I want to reference it in other places, but the teachers talk about a predator being in their midst.
Mm-hmm.
Is there perhaps a connection between the Woodrun and a witch hunt?
That's a good observation. It's a good observation. I think it's very good. That's much better. That's much better than your light in the hallway. That's much stronger.
Fair enough. So, I gotta say, this next sequence introduces my favorite character in the entire series. Absolutely. And I believe you know specifically who I'm talking about here, is the additional teacher who appears.
Right.
Now that is, right. He is a handsome man and a great character.
And somehow got through this without having anything shoved through his brain or without being chopped in two.
Yeah.
One of the few people to be written into this book by Joe that didn't meet a ghastly end straight away. So congratulations on surviving your first experience in the book, I guess.
Well, I gotta say, this means that he's probably gonna come back at some point.
If I'd known. Oh, he'll come back. He'll come back. Again, much like the Kenny Powers thing, if I'd known, I would have done things differently.
Well, you know, given this character, and I've always thought this, he could make an excellent He could make an excellent love interest for Miss Dagny, I would assume.
Is this a little teacher's lounge romance?
Yeah, why not? I mean, if all of the kids have their hormones
ready. Is that our Glee issue?
Yeah. Yeah, why not?
Let me see what I can do.
But, you know, if he doesn't have a name now, so if you need one, I've got a pretty good one handy for you.
All right. I think we can pull that off.
Outside of me being completely narcissistic, though, just because I got an appearance, I do like that there is an extra teacher. I really do, because so far we had only seen the four, if I'm correct.
There are five.
We've seen five.
We have seen others, yeah.
Because there was the teacher in the issue 10 as well.
Yeah, we've seen a couple of other teachers, but very, very briefly. Because I think we saw another one in issue 3. We saw another teacher. They're around.
Well, for me, they're often like the students, where, you know, we see plenty of students, but we only see... You know, we only see the world through our specific six.
Sure.
So, you know, getting another teacher or something, especially in this scene, which is just hundreds of thousands of students all over the place, it's a nice way to sort of build that world out, I guess, is the way to say it.
Yeah.
But with all of these students here, and I forgot to ask this in the last one, it becomes more apparent later on in further issues that these students see the world very differently than our six.
Right.
Because so far, most of them don't... You get, like, little moments, I guess, every now and then where someone will make a reference to it, but in this issue, we've got, you know, the girls who are talking in the bathroom with Zoe in the stall, and they're just talking about, well, you know, murder is just part of another day at Morning Glory Academy. They're not really disturbed about that.
All right.
Is that kind of it's a curious element? I'll say that.
Yeah, I mean, what you see with the other kids at the school are various degrees, I think, of if you want to call it brainwashing or just submissiveness. You know, that some of the kids, you know, especially some of the ones who haven't been there very long. You'll see a little bit more individuality and they'll talk a little more freely. And then as you get into some of the kids who have been there a long time, you know, they seem to be distinctly more a part of the groupthink. And we see this more in 18. So it's there's not a specific approach to the kids, you know, they're all in sort of different places. So
what I like here now is that as we move on and we've seen how the other group reacts to the wood run is that they're basically like, we're taking no part of this. We have our own thing to do. We're making a run for it. Zoe is totally into it.
Well, they have stuff she wants.
It's not just another stuff she thing, wants; they're her thing things. She's very specific that they are her things, and
which is something that Zoe can very much wrap her head around. That's her. She can very much. Pursues things she wants. So.
Well, what I was going to ask is that, you know, we've seen the front that Zoe puts on, and we've seen the softer sides of her where she's more compassionate and it's often usually quieter moments when she's by herself, or she doesn't think anybody's looking, at least. Sure. With this, though, it doesn't necessarily seem like this is her just putting on a front. At least from my read of the material, that's not what I got from it. And you know very specifically that I have a very firm belief of Zoe being multifaceted, let's say, with her personality.
Right. Sure.
So is that sort of a wrong thing to kind of be assuming here, or is this really just part of her front?
I mean, she wants to win this thing. You know, she really does. I think Zoe, throughout this sort of journey that she's been on at the Academy, she initially went along with Casey's plan to help Jade, and she wasn't entirely opposed to the idea of helping Jade and doing the right thing. But even in issue 7, you saw her sort of assessing where that had placed her within the school and questioning whether or not that was the right approach. And being a little frustrated, I think, with her fellow new entrants and the way that they were handling things. And so she pondered for a second there, sort of hitching her horse to a different wagon, with the cheerleading squad. And I think that the moments that you saw earlier of Hunter's sort of outburst at her and what she hears in the restroom, all those things, I think she has a moment where it sort of clicks in her head, and she probably feels like she's had to endure more than she needed to for the sake of these people who don't really like her to begin with, and that maybe trying to be a better person isn't necessarily the way to go, which doesn't mean any kind of full villain turn or anything like that, but that, you know, on the whole, maybe being friends with people like Hunter isn't in the cards. And so she's looking at the wood run and a chance to win the wood run as an opportunity to sort of curry favor, to establish herself at the school. There's a little bit of an Ike approach here. And I think we have only done a couple of scenes with Ike and Zoe, but I think that you saw that they could very much understand one another in terms of their approaches. And I think that this is actually her kind of taking a page from Ike's book to some extent and saying, I'm going to play within the rules here and get what I need out of it.
So this next sequence back in 1693, it reminds me a lot of the previous issue with the various panels of different moments in time. Mm-hmm. If only because the parallels here are fairly on purpose. I would go so far as to say when this might be a little bit more direct than the other one.
Yeah.
But this does basically continue that motif that or not even the motif, but that idea that we talked about earlier, that whatever is going on here in 1693 is directly reflecting the future, right? Because this character, Mary, is describing what's happening.
Right.
What's curious about it here is the final moment, among other curious things, obviously, because, you know, there's the line, to see who could tell the truth from the deceptions, but I don't think I can trick you into explaining that one. But when it all goes dark, and there's this moment where you see everything bright with June and Hunter and Zoe, and her eyes are closed, or she's looking down at the paper at least, and it all goes dark, and it's the same panel except her eyes are opened.
All right.
That's a pretty, you know, I guess I can't tell if I'm seeing things because I want to see lights at the bottom of tunnels, or if because I'm
this is really going to be several hours of she's not really dead, right? No. It's meant to reflect a sort of split second change. You know, that one second the lights are on, the next second the lights are off. Anything else that you take from that, I have nothing to say about.
So if I were to say that I think, you know, everything going dark was Zoe's fault, you mm-hmm. wouldn't necessarily comment on that.
I will go ahead and confirm. I like, you know, I gotta give you some stuff here. It is not Zoe's fault.
But it's still somebody's fault, right?
I'm not gonna say that. But I will go ahead and tell you that it's not Zoe's fault.
So
that's a very generous one.
I mean, there's certainly something. I don't know if this is the right word for it, but it's almost kind of magical about what's happening in this scenario. Like, this is, we touched on this earlier, but this is something that doesn't, I would assume, probably doesn't have a firm scientific explanation.
Well, I'm not going to comment on that. I will say that when we did this, I was excited about it and nervous about it, because I think it's one of the more fantastical things that we've done. And again, we talked a little bit about this, but these kids have seen certain things, but there's not a great deal that they've seen that really defies all possible explanation. And you see them here thinking, you know, that it's an eclipse, possibly. But obviously that won't hold very long as an explanation. And so this is a big moment in terms of deciding exactly how far we were going to go with these things. But this is it's a pretty critical moment to the story. So it was the right thing to do. But you know, it definitely changes the way that it certainly will over time change the way that they view where they are and what's going on.
So, okay. Let me see if I can phrase this correctly. At this point in the story, we certainly don't know what happened, but you know, later on there are a few hints as to where the children have gone. Mm-hmm. And it looks more specifically like it's not just a random eclipse or something of that sort, but that they've actually perhaps changed location, if not in space, but perhaps in time. Mm-hmm. And we've seen in another issue previously that there has also been a change in time, if also a change perhaps in space. Mm-hmm. Is there a relation between the two?
That I can't say. But yeah, aww. I will say that will certainly be answered here in the next arc. You'll have a firmer idea about that.
Mm-hmm. There's another thing here. I don't think this might be, actually, I think it is a Joe-only thing, but the paintings in the background, and there was one in the last issue that we didn't talk about. But you have had, or do you give Joe's any pointers, any cues on background art that's in the facility?
No.
All right. That's a fair answer.
But so, again, good eye.
So the teachers, this is really what I wanted to talk about. At the very beginning of the issue, you know, they're planning, and we've made a few references towards what they could possibly be planning. It very much seemed to me like, you know, maybe there was a witch hunt, or I think they use the exact line. Yes, we have a predator in our midst. That's the exact line. And it seems like they want to flush him or her or it out.
Right.
But at the end, everything goes pretty haywire. Exactly. And they don't seem to be in charge of the situation anymore. So is it fair to assume that it's basically all going wrong for them
here? Yes. Yes. Where you see Miss Derma in particular is they've set this trap. And they've organized the wood run with the intention of snaring a person that has been killing students. And once the sky goes dark for Zoe and John and Hunter, and all the other kids, obviously, they have lost track of them. So this attempt that they made has very much backfired and blown up in their faces.
And it's probably fair to assume that someone is doing this against them.
I'm not going to say that, but good try. Good try.
You know, most of the time when you say that you're not going to respond to things, it does make it seem like I'm right.
Well, I'll throw in a few where you're wrong, just to help with that then.
Yeah, just to mix it up.
All right.